Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Vayetzi, that's Genesis 28, verse 10, through 32, verse 2. Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. He encountered the place and spent the night there because the sun had set. He took from the stones of the place which he arranged around his head and lay down in that place. And he dreamt, and behold, a ladder was set earthward, and its top reached heavenward. And behold, angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Behold, the Lord was standing over him, and he said, I am the Lord, God of Abraham, your father, and God of Isaac. The ground upon which you are lying, to you I will give it, and to your descendants. Your offspring shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out powerfully, westward, eastward, northward, and southward. And all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you and by your offspring. Behold, I am with you. I will guard you wherever you go. I will return you to this soil, for I will not forsake you until I will have done what I have spoken about you. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is present in this place, and I did not know. And he became frightened and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the abode of God. This is the gate of heavens. Jacob arose early in the morning and took the stone that he placed around his head and set it up as a pillar. He poured oil on its top, and he named that place Bethel. However, Luz was the city's name originally. Then Jacob took a vow, saying, if God will be with me, will guard me on this way that I am going, will give me bread to eat and clothes to wear, and I return in peace to my father's house, the Lord will be a God to me. Then this stone which I have set up as a pillar shall become a house of God, and whatever you will give me, I shall repeatedly tithe to you. Chapter 29. So Jacob lifted his feet and went toward the land of the Easterners. He looked and behold, a well in the field. Behold, three flocks of sheep lay there beside it. For from that well they would water the flocks, and the stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks would be assembled there, they would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep. Then they would put back the stone over the mouth of the well in its place. Jacob said to them, my brothers, where are you from? They said, we are from Haran. He said to them, do you know Laban, son of Nahor? They said, we know. They said to them, is it well with him? They answered, it is well. And see, his daughter, Rachel, is coming with a flock. He said, look, the day is still long. It's not time to bring the flocks in. Water the flock and go on grazing. But they said to him, we will not be unable until all the flocks will have been gathered, and they will roll the stone off the mouth of the well. We will then water the flock. While he was still speaking with them, Rachel had arrived with her father's flock, for she was a shepherdess. And it was, when Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the flock of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came forward and rolled the stone off the mouth of the well and watered the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. Jacob kissed Rachel and he raised his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative, that he was Rebekah's son. Then she ran and told her father. And it was, when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, he ran toward him, embraced him, kissed him, took him to his house, and recounted to Laban all these events. Laban said to him, Nevertheless, you are my flesh and blood. And he stayed with him a month's time. Then Laban said to Jacob, just because you are my relative, should you serve me for nothing? Tell me, what are your wages? Laban had two daughters. The name of the older one was Leah. The name of the younger one was Rachel. Leah's eyes were tender, but Rachel was beautiful of form and beautiful of appearance. Jacob loved Rachel. He said, I will work for you 7 years, for Rachel, your younger daughter. Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than I give her to another man. Remain with me. So Jacob worked 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. And Jacob said to Laban, deliver my wife, my term is fulfilled, and I will consort with her. Laban gathered all the people of the place and made a great feast. And it was in the evening he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him, and he consorted with her. Laban gave her Zilpah, his maidservant, as a maidservant to Leah, as his daughter. And it was in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. So said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I worked for you? Why have you deceived me? Laban said, such is not done in our place, to give the younger before the older. Complete the week of this one, and will give to you the other one too, for the work which you will perform for me yet another 7 years. So Jacob did so, and he completed the week for her, and he gave him Rachel, his daughter, to him as a wife. Laban gave Rachel, his daughter, Bilhah, his maidservant, to her as a maidservant. He consorted also with Rachel and loved Rachel even more than Leah, and he worked for him yet another 7 years. The Lord saw that Leah was unloved, so he opened her womb, but Rachel remained barren. Leah conceived and bore a son. She called his name Reuben, as she had declared, because the Lord has discerned my humiliation, for now my husband will love me. She conceived again and bore a son and declared, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has given me also this one. She called his name Simeon. Again she conceived and bore a son and declared, this time my husband will become attached to me, for I have borne him three sons. Therefore, he called his name Levi. She conceived again and bore a son and declared, this time let me gratefully praise the Lord. Therefore, she called his name Judah. Then she stopped giving birth. Chapter 30. Rachel saw that she had not borne children to Jacob, so Rachel became envious of her sister. She said to Jacob, give me children, otherwise I am dead. Jacob's anger flared up at Rachel and said, am I instead of God who has withheld you from the fruit of the womb? And she said, here is my maid, Bilhah, consort with her, that she may bear upon my knees, and I too may be built up through her. So she gave him Bilhah, her maidservant, as a wife. And Jacob consorted with her, and Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Rachel said, God has judged me. He has also heard my voice and has given me a son. She therefore called his name Dan. Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And Rachel said, sacred schemes have I maneuvered to equal my sister, and I have also prevailed. She called his name Naphtali. When Leah saw that she had stopped giving birth, she took Zilpah, her maidservant, and gave her to Jacob his wife. And Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, bore Jacob a son. Leah declared, good luck has come. She called his name Gad. Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, bore a second son to Jacob, and Leah declared, in my good fortune, for women have deemed me fortunate. So she called his name Asher. Reuben went out in the days of the wheat harvest. He found Dudaim in the field and brought them to Leah, his mother. Rachel said to Leah, please, give me some of your sons, Dudaim. She said to her, was your taking my husband insignificant, and now to take even my sons, Dudaim? Rachel said, therefore shall I lie with you tonight and return for your sons to Dudaim. When Jacob came from the field the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, it is to me that you must come, for I have clearly hired you with my sons to Dudaim. So He lay with her that night. God hearkened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. And Leah declared, God has granted me my reward, because I gave my maidservant to my husband. So she called his name Issachar. Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son, and Leah said, God has endowed me with good endowment. Now my husband will make his permanent home with me, for I have borne him six sons. She called his name Zebulun. Afterwards, she bore a daughter, and she called her name Dinah. God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her, and he opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son, and said, God has taken away my disgrace. So she called his name Yosef, saying, may the Lord add on me for another son. It was when Rachel had given birth to Yosef, Jacob said to Laban, grant me leave that I may go to my place and to my land. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and I will go. For you are aware of my service that I labored for you. But Laban said to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me on account of you. He said, specify your wage to me, and I will give it. But he said to him, you know how I served you, and what your livestock were with me. For the little that you had before I came has expanded substantially, as the Lord has blessed you with my coming. And now, when will I also do something for my own house? So he said, what shall I give you? And Jacob said, do not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will resume pasturing and guarding your flocks. Let me pass through your whole flock today. Remove from there every speckled or spotted lamb, every brownish lamb among the sheep, and the spotted and speckled among the goats. That will be my wage. Let my integrity testify for me in the future when it comes before you regarding my wage. If any among the goats that is not speckled or spotted, or among the sheep that is not brownish, is considered stolen, if in my possession. Laban said, agreed, if only it will be as you say. So he removed on that very day the ringed, the spotted he-goats, and all the speckled and spotted goats, every one that contained white as well as all the brownish ones among the sheep, and he left them in charge of his sons. He put a distance of 3 days between himself and Jacob tended Laban's remaining flock. Jacob then took himself fresh rods of poplar and hazel and chestnut. He peeled white streaks in them, laying bare the white of the rods. He set up the rods which he had peeled in the runnels and the watering receptacles which the flocks came to drink, facing the flocks so they would become stimulated when they came to drink. Then the flocks became stimulated by the rods, and the flocks gave birth to ringed ones, to speckled ones, to spotted ones. Jacob segregated the lambs, and he made the flocks face the ringed ones and the brownish ones among Laban's flocks. He formed separate droves of his own, and did not mingle them with Laban's flocks. Whenever it was mating time for the early bearing flocks, Jacob would place the rods in the runnels, in view of the flock, to stimulate them among the rods. When the sheep were late bearing, he would not in place. Thus the late bearing ones went to Laban, and the early ones went to Jacob. The man became exceedingly prosperous, and he attained fecund flocks, maidservants, servants, camels, and donkeys. Chapter 31. Then he heard the word of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken all that belonged to our father. From that which belonged to our father, he amassed all his wealth. Jacob also noticed that Laban's disposition, that behold, it was not toward him as in earlier days. The Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers, and to your native land, and I will be with you. Jacob sent and summoned Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock, and he said to them, I have noticed that your father's disposition is not toward me as it was in earlier days, but the God of my father was with me. Now you have known that it was with all my might that I served your father. Yet your father mocked me and changed my wage 10 times. But God did not permit him to harm me. if he would stipulate speckled ones should be your wages for the entire flock, or speckled ones. If he would stipulate ringed ones should be your wages, the entire flock, or ringed ones. Thus God took away your father's livestock and gave them to me. It once happened at mating time of the flock that I raised my eyes and saw in a dream, behold, the he-goats that met the flock were ringed, speckled, and checkered. And an angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob. I said, here I am. He said, raise your eyes, if you please, and see that all the he-goats mount the flocks are ringed, speckled, and checkered. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. For I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, and when you made me a vow, now arise, leave this land, and return to your native land. The Rachel and Leah replied and said to him, have we then still a share and an inheritance in our father's house? Are we not considered by him as strangers? For he has sold us and even totally consumed our money. But all the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. So now, whatever God has said to you, do. Jacob arose and lifted his children and his wives to their camels. He led away all of his livestock and all the wealth which he had amassed, his purchased property which he had amassed in Padan Aram, to go to his father Isaac, to the land of Canaan. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole the teraphim that belonged to her father. Jacob deceived Laban at the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing, and thus he fled with all he had. He arose and crossed the river, and he set his direction toward Mount Gilead. It was told to Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled. So he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days, catching up with him on Mount Gilead. But God had come to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, beware, lest you speak with Jacob either good or bad. Laban overtook Jacob, and Jacob had pitched his tent on the mountain. Laban had stationed his kinsmen on Mount Gilead. Laban said to Jacob, what have you done that you have deceived me and led my daughters away like captives of the sword? Why have you fled so stealthily and cheated me? Nor did you tell me, for I would have sent you off with gladness, with songs, with timbrel, with lyre. You don't even allow me to kiss my sons and daughters. Now you have acted foolishly. It is in my power to do you all harm. But the God of your father addressed me last night, saying, beware, speaking with Jacob, either good or bad. Now you have left because you have longed greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods? Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I thought perhaps you might steal your daughters from me. With whomever you find your gods, he shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, ascertain for yourself what is with me and take it back. But Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Then he came to Jacob's tent, and to Leah's tent, and the tent of the two maidservants, but he found nothing. When he had left Leah's tent, he came into Rachel's tent. And Rachel had taken the teraphim and put them into the camel's pack saddle and sat on them. Laban rummaged through the whole tent, but found nothing. He said to her father, let not my lord be angered that I cannot rise up before you, for the way of women is upon me. Thus he searched, but did not find the teraphim. Then Jacob became angered and took up his grievance with Laban. Jacob spoke and said to Laban, what is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? When you rummaged through all my things, what did you find of all your household objects? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, and let them decide between the two of us. These 20 years I have been with you, for your ewes and your she-goats never miscarried, nor did I eat rams of your flock. That which was mangled I never brought to you. I myself would bear the loss. From me you would exact it, whether it was stolen by day or stolen by night. This is how I was. By day scorching heat consumed me, and frost by night. My sleep drifted from my eyes. This is my 20 years in your household. I have served you 14 years for 2 daughters, and 6 years for your flocks. and you change my wage 10 times, had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the dread of Isaac, been with me, you would surely have now sent me away empty-handed. God saw all my wretchedness and the toil of my hands, so he admonished you last night." Laban spoke up and said to Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters. The children are my children. The flock is my flock. And all that you see is mine. Yet to my daughters, what could I do to them this day? Or to their children whom they have born? So now, come. Let's make a covenant, I and you. And you shall be a witness between me and you." Jacob took a stone and raised it up as a monument, and Jacob said to his brethren, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a mound, and they ate there on the mound. And Laban called it Yegar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Laban declared, "This mound is a witness between me and you." Therefore they called its name Galeed. And as for Mizpah, because he said, "May the Lord keep watch between me and you, and when we are out of each other's sight. If you will ill-treat my daughters, or if you will marry wives in addition to my daughters, though no man may be among us, but see, God is a witness between me and you." Laban said to Jacob, "Here is this mound, and here is the mound which I have cast between me and you. This mound should be a witness, and the monument should be a witness, that I may not cross over to you past this mound, nor may you cross over to me past this mound, or this monument, for any evil. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor judge between us, and the God of their father." Jacob swore by the dread of his father Isaac, and then Jacob slaughtered for a feast on the mountain and summoned his kinsmen to break bread. They broke bread and spent the night on the mountain. And Laban awoke early the next morning. He kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. Laban went and returned to his place. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of the God encountered him. Jacob said when he saw them, "This is a godly camp." So he called the name of that place Manahim. I still have a few questions. Go ahead.
Okay, seriously, why were the angels there like that?
Good question. What are the angels doing there? Let's see, where's my notebook? There it is. So, okay, are you referring to which time? The latter part, the angels, or mean the camp part, the angels? They were both times. Right. And at the end. Right. Ah. It was part of the deal. When Jacob encountered God at Bethel, with the ladders going up and down, mind you, remember what Jacob is, what's going through his head. He's being essentially fleeing from death from his brother because he deceived his brother and he does not know if God is pleased with him or not. If you had deceived your sibling and stole from them, would you think God was pleased with you or not? Generally not. Most of the, oops, we purposely deceived someone and got huge amounts of stuff from them, from blessings as well as possessions, and God would not normally be pleased with us. Now, mind you, Jacob fled with nothing but, you know, the cloak in his hand, a staff, and probably a little bit of some food along the way. Not much is with him. So he didn't get to keep any of the birthright, meaning with the possessions, but he did receive it as far as the official blessing. Either way, he does not know if God's happy with him, if God's angry with him. All he perceives is, I am being evicted from my family and from the property that my grandfather and my father, that God swore would be them and their descendants. I don't know if it'll go through me or not, because Jacob doesn't know. But he's being evicted from it. So in Jacob's mind, is God happy with me? Is God not happy with me? So what's the first symbol he gets? The first moment God says, "Hey, Jacob, by the way, I'm God. Nice to meet you. This is the deal. I'll be with you. If you come back, you go, and you come back again. I'll be with you. And we will all go well." So God is reiterating to him, it's okay. I'll take care of you. So we end the story with the same imagery that Jacob sees. God's here with me. All these angels are around. Clearly, God is still with me. So I left, though I couldn't see God. God was still with me. All the way I returned, now he sees God again. So he sees, oh, God was reiterating, I am still here. You didn't do this alone. Yes.
So even though he got that by deceit, God still honored what Abraham said? Meaning because, like, so does that show you that, that authority?
We're going to discuss that. That deceit is an important thing that a lot of people think have a hard time relating to him because he deceived his sibling. But that's a good thing for us, and we'll discuss that.
Okay, and then there was another, well, there was a few things, but the ascending and descending, meaning the angels, it sounds like they were already here on the earth because it said ascend
and descend.
And then descending. It wasn't saying they were coming down, they were going up and down first, so perhaps.
Yeah, you could argue as far as the, I don't know, I don't know if choosing the word descending first for us, I don't know if swapping the words, whether that means anything or not. I do not know. I've never considered that. It's possible. I do not know. Somebody else. Yes.
I just found it comical in 29:13-14. Jacob told his story so far to Laban. He's like, you're truly my relative. So here's what happened, Uncle Laban. I tricked my brother Esau. You were truly my relative.
Yeah, that is funny. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Laban is a somewhat of a deceiving character, as we learn from this part of the story. Somewhat, yes. And Jacob, of course, has a history also of deceiving his brother. So that's an interesting relation. I haven't thought about that before. Yes.
Where it said that Jacob, after one more week, he took Rachel. Now, was that a week or was it 7 years like he said he would?
A week. It would be a week. So he works 7 years. He receives Leah as a wife. He fulfills her week. He then receives Rachel as a wife, fulfills her week, then works 7 more years afterward. He got both wives within about a 2-week period. Give or take a day. I'm not going to split hairs on it. Yeah, 2 honeymoons. So he took off for 2 weeks. He enjoyed himself for a couple weeks. I won't go there. Anyway, so that's so he got both wives. So at the same time or near the same time, obviously Leah was first, and then he had to work the additional 7 years. And then that second set of 7 years when he had all those kids, all these they were given birth and had the extra wives, all of their stuff. Yes, Dan.
I also like how Laban tried to take advantage of Jacob many, many times, and God intervened, and then he realized God is with this man.
Yep, yep.
No matter what I do to him, he still prospers. So I thought that was really cool, because Jacob wasn't in a position, I don't think, to say anything to him, but God worked behind the scenes and still prospered him.
Yeah. Because again, because Jacob's still inside of Laban's house, so all of his possessions are always there. You can't bite the hand that feeds you, so to speak. yes, Anne.
It was kind of interesting that Laban was pretty much like, was it Balaam that in the end there said, don't say anything evil
similar,
or good.
Yes. You only say Balaam's instruction was, only say what I tell you to say from God. There's a similarity to the story, and it's not by accident that they are similar.
Also, the curse. I don't know if remember he said if anybody finds the household gods.
Oh right.
You know Rebecca, Rachel.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But you know I wonder if he didn't speak a curse over her when he didn't know she had those household gods. I mean some of that's in the extra biblical books of what really did happen, but. Just if you have any knowledge or anything you want to share on that.
Not much beyond what's already written here. It's pretty obvious that he did not know. It indicates explicitly he did not know she had them. When it comes to cursing someone, it's a big deal. It's not a flippant thing that our culture considers, forget you kind of thing. We curse so they don't even care. It actually means something, and God is not ignorant of the words that come out of our mouths. That's the reason why We're instructed, you should know that cursing and blessings don't come out of the same mouth. And it's the stuff that comes out of it that makes you foul and unclean. Yes.
I'm having a difficult time establishing a foundation. I always have a foundation upon which to build. But the foundation here with Jacob, 2 wives, a lot of children, 2 sisters, it just doesn't make sense to me.
We're going to try to explain a little bit about that today. Now, I don't have all the explanations, but there's the storyline, although it has obviously the women and such involved in it, it's a little bit different than what it may appear on the surface. The surface appears, obviously, okay, he has four wives, a bunch of kids. That's pretty much what it feels. And he got through various deceptions and some bickering back and forth, yada, yada, yada. Pretty basic, you know, simple story. But that's not the point of the story. If we look at who Jacob, what the character Jacob's playing, the character Laban's playing, it makes a little more sense, more clarity as far as what's actually going on and how we then can relate to Jacob far more than what we, than the story appears to be. We'll discuss that a little bit today. All right. The questions or comments?
I'm thinking while he's building this family, where do you find time to build the herd?
Well, you know, yeah, you have a lot of kids, and I got five kids. It takes a lot of effort, and okay, wives, servants, somebody else, you go take care of my these kids of mine. That's a lot of work. I get that. Yeah, it's a lot of work. You're working full time just to keep things going. Oh, yes.
I always thought somehow the poplars and the almonds.
Right, right.
Had something to do with the sheep all coming out speckled and banded and whatever.
Right.
And now today, the Lord said, it has nothing to do with them. It was all me.
Right. Right.
Finally, I got an answer.
Yes, the poplars and the sticks, that is not an uncommon trick for sheep in general. In that it's the smell of the freshly stripped sticks that makes the female sheep think that, oh, this is a rich and abundant place of food. Well, when sheep, females in particular, believe or feel like there's lots of food around, they go into heat. Because they can produce, then it's easier for them to actually produce more lambs. So that's not uncommon. And that when farmers today, sheep farmers today, they have their sheep in their various pens. When it's ready to feed it for mating time, they move into a new paddock, which has lots of big, fresh, green grass. And when they start eating it, they release the billy goats into it too. Because the sheep say, oh, hey, there's plenty of food. Now we can have babies. And so they go through the process. It's a pretty common trick. There's nothing strange or unique about it. Except that in Jacob's time, they didn't use paddocks because they were roaming droves of sheep herders. It wasn't like a fenced off piece of land like we do today. Because it was, I won't discuss the reasons why. So he didn't have that option. However, at the watering trough, you have plenty of options. So he strips all the bark up. It gives the same scent or smell as fresh green grass does. So they enjoy the, oh, there's plenty of food here. And then they can go ahead and have their babies. Make sense? It's pretty common done today for sheep and goats. I don't know about cows, but sheep and goats is still commonly done. Yes.
Also, of course, when I was listening to it, it said that Laban learned something by divination.
Yeah. We'll discuss
that
a little
bit. So I want to talk about that. What that means, and it has, was it, you know, he said by divination.
Yeah, the Hebrew word there can be translated by divination, experience, understanding, through great comprehension or discussion. They can be used, any of those terms can be translated in that form. So, right, he has his pagan gods, which we'll discuss that a little bit. They were people not ignorant. Okay, so let's go through this. First of all, Jacob leaves Beersheba, which I didn't get a map of Beersheba, but it's way down south. And he goes to Bethel, which up here, this my little map up here, which Jeff so kindly put up there. Bethel is way up there in the corner next to I. Bethel, have we heard of Bethel before? Yes. Who went to Bethel? Abraham. What did he do at Bethel? He built an altar. It was called Luz, but the Bible doesn't record it as Luz. I don't want to go into the great discussion of the authorship of the Bible, so let's go past that, but we're calling it Bethel for today, because that's an in-depth discussion on who wrote what when. Anyway, so he built an altar at Bethel. And the particular unique thing about Abraham's altar is this altar is where Abraham called on the name of the Lord. Now, he also built an altar in Shechem, where Abraham did not call the name of the Lord. This was just a, thank you God, I made it here to Canaan, we're all alive. Bethel, Abraham, here is an altar called by the name of the Lord that God would save him and obviously bless him. Abraham goes down to Egypt that time after he gets and deceives Pharaoh, all the good stuff, gets all their supplies. He comes back, then returns to Bethel, and again, calls the name of the Lord again. So Bethel, in Abraham's time, he built a significant altar there. I don't know how many years lapsed between the first one before he returned, but some period of time lapsed. He comes back to Bethel, where he called the name of the Lord. Now, it's important to remember that God's name means a lot to him. I won't go into the various cultural beliefs as far as, well, you should and shouldn't speak his name. He declares what his name is, and he says, this is my name, you will declare it on. I declare it because it knows that, you know that I'm addressing you and you're addressing me when you're speaking to me. So he calls the name of the Lord, and that's what Abraham did. Now, Jacob then comes to Bethel again. What does Jacob see when he's there? He sees a ladder. What's going on in this ladder, this place? Going up and down, angels up and down. Or down and up, fine. We'll pull the arrow up and down. You guys can choose which one went first. So angels going up and down this ladder. Now, Jacob is, yeah, we know. I don't know what the ladder looked like. It could be a staircase. Some say it's straight. Some say it's really wide. I don't know. Doesn't make a difference. It's a spiral. Sure, it could be a spiral. And what does he see in this ladder, at the top ladder? Where are the angels? What are they doing? They're going up and down, right? And who's up there?
God.
Because he sees God's up there because God is addressing him. He's going up to heaven. And what are they doing down here on earth? What do angels do down here on earth? They minister. The term angel is a servant, someone who serves or works for or does something. He's busy doing something. Now, why couldn't they use their wings and fly? Maybe they don't have any. I don't know. Whatever reason, they didn't use their wings. So maybe they don't have wings. I don't know. Some have wings, some don't. I don't know. Either way, they use a ladder. They didn't have elevators or escalators. They use a ladder. I will discuss the reasons why. Maybe God said, get the lead out, get some work, don't get too fat. Make the angels go up and down the long way. That's okay. And of course, God addresses Jacob down below and says, quote, this, hi, I'm the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and yada, yada, yada. What I want to bring your attention to is the connection of this vision that Jacob has with the altar that Abraham built. Okay? When you and I, we read our Torahs or anywhere in the Bible, it could be anywhere in the Bible, we're discussing an altar, what do we think of? What do you imagine in your head? This is an altar, and animals going up on it, or burning up on it. What do you think that that's meaning to God when you're doing this? A sacrifice? Connecting with God? Any other? Appeasing a God, if you wish to appease him for if he's upset with you for a sin or whatever. His presence for the altar of incense in particular is obviously his various presence for the prayers. When we discuss altars and to talk about them in the ancient world, is not so much today, but we do it, but I'll discuss that in a minute. In the ancient world, they believe there's some kind of a connection to God, like a communication channel, like a telephone, so to speak. You're calling him up and saying, here is my gift to you. Well, Jacob's vision explains how the altar concept works. That Jacob is now seeing what this altar Abraham's does. It is, as Jacob calls it, a gateway to heaven. It's a gateway, a communication channel, a telephone line. It's a way which you can communicate from here to there and back again. That's what the altars are for. That's their imagery behind them. Hence, we get the idea of the animal's burning up and smoke goes up and the animal gets smaller and turns into ash. And then what animal was once this big is now down in a bowl this size. Well, where'd all this go? The big animal go? It went up in the smoke, up in the heavens. That's the idea of what you imagery see. Well, when we're discussing God looking down at us, the idea is that the angels of God are taking your messages, your offerings, whatever it may be, up to God, and then God bringing his blessings or his servants back down to you. That's the idea of the communication channel, a place which you can talk to. Yes?
Remember where it is in Revelation, but where it talks about the golden bowls filled up with the prayers of the saints, and then the fire of God bringing all, you know, his power coming back down to earth to answer those prayers.
Exactly. That the same, it's the same exact image. That's a perfect example of it. The idea that God is communicating back down through the same channel that has been opened up to him. Through that, the example of Revelation is through the prayer was the channel, and this altar is more of animals the channel. It's the same channel being spoken to or spoken through. Yes.
I know I'm always a couple of paragraphs behind, but I'm back with the staircase.
Go ahead.
And it's a spiral staircase, and there's a spiral going up, but then there's a spiral coming down.
It could be.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, as a child, I always saw a spiral going up, and then of angels going up, and a spiral of angels coming down at the same time.
That could be, because they can't they run into each other.
But that was a personal vision from God, which means that that was correct.
But fair enough. That was correct. She had it verified and sealed. That's what it is. So, now we have this idea of what the altar is for and how God uses it in the communication process. So now we have the idea of what Jacob is dealing with and how God's communicating with Jacob. So what was the message to Jacob? What were the angels bringing to him? What was his message? They would inherit the land. And God's not angry with you, but that you will go, but you will come back. And God said, I will be with you until I have fulfilled everything I've promised to you. Now, does that mean just the part of going and coming back? No. What's the whole promise? The inheritance of the whole land. Well, Jacob died before that happened. He still gets it, though. Just because you don't live through the process doesn't mean you don't get it. You still get it anyway. Just Abraham dies, Isaac, they all die, but they still get their promise. The agreement is still carried on and still strong as always. So God gave these promises. So one, I'll be with you wherever you go, and you'll come back, he'll bring you back. And the land you're sleeping on is going to give to you and your descendants. And I'll be with you all the way until it's completely done. Is it even done today? No, not yet. So God's still with Jacob. But Jacob's dead. But all of his descendants are not. So God's still with everyone. He has to fulfill that agreement that he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And it's not finished yet. Still working on it. But that every descendant is a recipient of that. What did God also tell Jacob in this vision? What was the other thing he said about the nations of the earth? They'll be blessed through you, the nations will be blessed through you and your descendants. So this promise was not just for Jacob, but all of his children. So God's telling Jacob, you're going to have children too. Which he didn't know yet. He didn't know what's going to happen. He's all on his own. So this communication moment, which God's talking to him, God essentially introduces himself to Jacob. Now, up to this point, we have no record of God and Jacob ever talking. This is the first one. Yes.
And on that note, I just find it interesting how God introduces himself as the God of his grandfather and of his father, but he doesn't say, I'm your God.
Right. Not yet.
And is that because Jacob has yet to acknowledge him as, because I noticed throughout the whole scripture, the fear of my father. And
yes.
So is that because Jacob has not received him himself?
Right. He's not received him yet. The instruction is that Jacob gives that when God finishes this vision, and Jacob responds to him the next morning, Jacob puts up the pillar, puts oil on it and such, says, if you do this for me, God, you will be my God. So Jacob, if this is the contract and you fulfill it, you will be my God. And then then people will address me as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If God, for whatever reason, chose not to fulfill it with Jacob, we wouldn't be reading about it. Abraham, Isaac, and somebody else, whoever the other person was, we wouldn't know anything about it. But Jacob had to come through a series of steps to understand what God was doing and brought him back again. And now I can look back at his life at this point toward the end of this section. Say, okay, now I see what God has done. now, okay, I understand how God is working with me, and I will be his servant, he will be my God. And then we get the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob from that point on as the God of Abraham, all three of them. Let's see here. Okay. Where was I? Oh, wrong notebook. Now, Jacob winds up keeping his vow to God. As far as when Jacob returns, this is recorded in chapter 35 of Exodus. When Jacob returns to Bethel, he winds up offering sacrifices there and has a big old party and such and gets rid of all the various gods and everything else that his servants and family have accumulated over the past 20 years or so. He winds up returning and because Jacob had specified, when I return, this place, Bethel, would be the house of God. Now, we look at our history books and we can look at our Bible and say, no, it wasn't. That didn't happen. God didn't use that. God didn't use Jacob. I don't understand. Jacob, you said that this place, Bethel, this way up here, this little spot up here, would be the house of God. But it isn't. The house of God wound up being in Jerusalem down here. They're not the same place. So what's Jacob doing? What is he? I don't understand. How is this possible? Is he just confused? Did God say, yeah, no thanks. I don't want this place as my house. What was that? A really big house. Bethel, yeah, front door and back door. Altar. Remember, this is association. The place was Abraham's altar that Abraham created and built. It's a communication place between Jacob and God with the latter imagery. Before that was communication between Abraham and God himself directly. It's not that the physical place Bethel has to be the house of God. It's the use of an altar is the house of God. It's that altar that defines it. How many of you have ever prayed in church before? Have you prayed in your own homes before? Yeah. Have you prayed anywhere before? In a car, anywhere, on the streets, whatever, calling out God, I'm in this mess, I can't get out of it. All those various times which you've prayed. Why is it that most of us would associate our church sanctuary area place differently or somehow unique than our homes or our cars and our streets? Have you noticed that? Well, not that you've been told it. We have learned something about it. When you are amongst a community of people who are praying, we feel a sense of one-ment or attachment to each other. We have a feeling of association. We have a commonality. That's where sanctuaries are built behind, that idea. And so most people come to church, they wind up praying more. Not saying they pray better, just more often. You're thinking about it, it's on your mind all the time. Oh, well, I'll talk to God for this reason or that reason or other things. That's not uncommon. Nothing wrong with that. What do you think temples were for? The same temples, what were temples used for? The same principle. Communicate between you and God. It's not that the temple itself is the end goal, it's the use of it is. So in Jacob's explanation of this Bethel being the place where God's at, doesn't mean that God has to have his temple physically at the city of Bethel. He can have it anywhere. It's the use of what it's being done, what's being done with it. It is a communication. God's house is where the altar is, where you're communicating with him. How many of us have prayed over our dinner tables? At them, over them? Prayed over your children at a given moment. Maybe sit down and pray over you or bless you if you have the chance to do so. We do so at Kaddush, that table back there all the time, every Shabbat. It's pretty commonly done. We use a particular spot and say, here's where to pray, do our prayers of this style, this nature, here and do it this way. Nothing wrong with it. It's just a way in which doing it. Does God then have a communication channel between us through that spot and him? Of course. It's nothing wrong with it. It becomes a temporary altar for us, so to speak. It's not a permanent one. It's the one he designed. That's one that we're using. Nothing uncommon about that or strange about it. Jacob's using this same imagery that God has to live at Bethel, not that he doesn't, but that it's the use of what Abraham built at Bethel, that action, that association. So Jacob said he's going to return there. He winds up doing so, and he offers up another altar with oil in a form of a big rock or a pillar. Jacob's big on using pillars. So if he uses a pillar, comes back later in chapter 35, and he puts oil on it again, just like he did it this time. So he's anointing a rock. And it gives him, obviously, what he wishes to give him as far as tithes and things of that nature, which we won't discuss at this time. How Beth is house, El is God, or strong one. El Shaddai would be God that destroys. The great destroyer, El Shaddai, which would be one of the names or titles of God at that time.
El Shaddai, God Almighty here.
Yes. Right. Not Bethel, right. God, the El Shaddai, house of God, or God's house.
So you had mentioned that Jacob erected a lot of pillars, or was dealing with pillars. There's a tradition that the king of kings of Scotland, I think Ireland, maybe Britain too, were sitting on that stone that
they slept on.
Slept on.
Yeah. It is a long tradition. I do not know if that's legitimate or not. I couldn't tell you. There's no way of knowing. I have heard the tradition that the stone that Jacob is referring to, the stone Jacob was sleeping on, his head that he rested his head on, made it through. The tradition goes that Jeremiah took it, obviously it was 1,000 years later, took it during the Babylonian, Nebuchadnezzar was coming and such, took it from there and took it over to, made its way along with some daughters of the king, with that all the way up into Ireland, England area, and repopulated there. A long-standing tradition, not enough evidence to say that was true or not. Couldn't tell you. There's a lot of books written about it, and the Scots still have that tradition as being true. I don't know if it's right or wrong, so I couldn't tell you. I have no idea. Whether that particular rock made it or not. I don't know which rock it would be, as far as you couldn't tell. It must be a nice, slightly encaved in one, because your head's going to want a more comfortable one. Maybe it's the right size for a rear end to sit down. I don't know. But whatever it is, hopefully it's comfortable.
Very skeptical, and the reason that it is, in fact, that particular stone, because at the time they wanted to have the rock actually analyzed and compared to the rock in Bethel. And the primates or whoever they were said, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, you don't do that. Because it's going to have different properties. If you get a chance to take a chunk off, and I have no idea how big the rock was, but big enough to rest your head and big enough to put a pillar on it, or a one man lift up as a pillar, can't be too big. I'm not sure the size of rock that the king supposedly sit on. Yes, Jeff. You'll check it out for us. Take a small chisel of it, just knock a cheese piece off and bring it back for us to analyze. Yes.
Maybe the stone is made from Blarney.
good puns. Blarney stone, full of good talk. Let's continue on. But it's Blarney stone is a Scottish tradition. You kiss the Blarney stone, Irish tradition, sorry, not Scottish. You kiss the Blarney stone and you have good pleasant words come out and you convince anybody to do anything. It's a... With Blarney. It's a bunch of garbage. But it's a tradition. Let's see. Was it... okay. So Jacob takes off. He leaves this territory behind, believing God's with him, which is great. He now knows God's not going to forsake him. He travels and takes off and goes to Haran. Got a little map up here. I'll switch to the next map, which is... a little button thingamajigger. That's it. This one. Back to that one again. There it is. Thank you. He travels from Bethel, which is just around here, which he spent the night. He's coming from Beersheba, which is down there, all the way up to Haran, where he finally makes his way back to meet for the first time Laban. Now, Laban, he does not know, or he's not met them before, he doesn't know what he looks like, so they're not sure who they are. But obviously, he feels a convincing story when he meets them. When Jacob first runs across, he sees the well. What's going on with the well? This is chapter 29. Jacob meets Rachel and the well that he goes to with all the shepherds. What's the first thing he runs across? Very deep. The deep well. This is a well that's out in the middle of, I guess, the desert area or desert climate area. Why is there a big rock on it? That could be. Nothing falls in, dies, damages the water. That's a good example. What are the reasons for the reason why there's a big rock on it?
It doesn't evaporate.
Doesn't evaporate? Why would you need a rock that, normally speaking, as the flock herders or shippers point out, you have to have all the flocks together, then they remove the stone. As a group, I'm assuming two or three guys take the stone and move it.
To save water?
Pause to save water. What are the reasons? Now, traditionally speaking, the belief is that the people where Laban lives are similar to Laban. So, if white lies, yeah. Is Laban a honest man or a dishonest man? Dishonest man. So the belief is the area itself where Abraham left, and Rebekah was a unique person amongst them, being an honest person. Laban was not an honest man, but he was considered a dishonest man. The belief is that many people in the area probably were dishonest. What would you want a dishonest community to agree upon?
Sharing the water.
Because if you don't, everyone dies, right? You run out of water, all the flocks die, all the animals die. So instead of having the stone removed and you watering your flocks alone, you have a lot of water that way and seal it back up again, it doesn't share it well. So they have a big stone requiring more than one person to move it, and or if the people can share, so you have a second witness to verify, I didn't steal water, we're all doing this exactly, we all seal it at the same time, we open at the same time, no unfair usage of a community property. Yes?
So would this mean that Jacob was possessed by superhuman strength because he rolled off the rock for Rachel?
Jacob was not a small man. No, he was not a tiny man. My eraser disappeared. It's over there. Jacob is related to his brother. What's Esau known for? What was that? Oh, too many things. Hairy red guy. And what was his occupation?
He was a hunter
and gatherer. He didn't gather much, but he did hunt a lot. He hunted a lot. Yeah. So, Jacob and Esau. Now, did it say Jacob was a small man and Esau was a big man? No. Yep. They are paternal twins. That's the right word. Paternal twins. So they have similar, though not necessarily identical, physical build. Reasonable expectation. So, Isaac, who's their dad, what was the one thing he was most known for other than the fact that he was almost offered up on a mountaintop with his dad who was killed him? What's his one thing he physically did all the time? Yes.
Digging wells.
Digging wells. How many of you dug a well before?
No.
You dug a well? Is it easy?
No,
it's not. It takes a lot of work, doesn't it? It takes a long time, too, doesn't it? It's a big undertaking. Now, he didn't just dig the wells one. There were many wells. I realized he had servants to help him, too. But the point is that they were all digging wells together. Now, after he physically dug the wells, how big of a person do you think he probably was? Probably decent-sized man. Not necessarily the biggest, not the smallest, but decent-sized man. So, if Isaac was a well digger, now he didn't fight over them, he wasn't a warrior, but he did dig wells, what did his dad do? His dad wasn't a well digger, though he dug a few, that's true. What's one of the few things that Abraham did with his 316 men?
Trained warriors.
Trained warriors. So Abraham, mind you, he went to Canaan when he was 75. So he already went through any military training he would have gone through when he was younger. And he had his own command of people that he was in charge of, and they could defend themselves in battle. Was Abraham probably a small man? No. I'm not sure what he looked like, but he probably looked pretty good size. So Abraham was probably a warrior of types. Mind you, he was concerned not by the nomads who would kill him, but rather by the kings who would kill him. Because kings have armies and many people in them. What do nomadic tribes have? A few. He wasn't concerned by them. He knew he could take care of himself with the small fry, so to speak. But bigger nations he would not be able to battle or conquer. So Abraham had a warrior knowledge or understanding. So he demonstrated or proved that. Isaac has a more calm disposition. He didn't go to war necessarily, but he was a very fairly decent or strong man in that the neighbors still feared him. We're still afraid of Isaac too, because Isaac was still big. He still had a large property and large accumulation. If you're a very small, weak person and you have lots and lots of property and money, what typically would happen to you in a thieving society? You'd be either gotten rid of and just have already taken, or at least taken from you without even a second thought. These men had to be decent enough in size to do so. And what's Jacob's motive in this instance? What's his motive for this moving this big rock? Right, but there's a particular girl he's interested in. Yeah, the girl. He did. No. He knew it because it says he asked the shepherds who were there. Have you heard of Laban? Yes. Is he well? Yes. And they said, here is his daughter coming with the shepherd. He sees her. He removes the stone and waters Laban's flock. Now, I'm not sure how physically close he was before he decided to move the stone, but probably close enough to realize that, hey, I like this girl. So, what is a fairly good-sized man? Yeah, 40. He's about 40, give or take, but 40 years old. So he lives really long. Going to wind up doing with to impress a young lady. That stone right off. I'll take care of y'all. So, he has motive that's a little bit beyond necessarily. He didn't have superhuman strength, but he has a drive, and he has a physical size to do so. So there's motive behind Jacob's intent. I mean, he's not a tiny person either. Shepherd? Yes, shepherd is a lot of physical work. It is a lot of physical work. Yep. It's a lot of physical work. Being a shepherd, because you're carrying sick or ill or whatever damaged beasts here and there all over the place, and you're walking huge amounts of distances. You're throwing through. There's a lot of things you're working on. Shepherd is a physical job. So he's going to have strong enough to be able to do those things and the physical physique to do so. Any one of them probably could have, but they were obeying the community law. See, they all of them had their community agreement. Jacob has no such agreement. He's not part of the community. So he just said, I'll just move it and water David's flock. Regardless of what the community agreement is, I mean, he's a stranger. There's lots of witnesses all verify that what he's doing, he didn't do anything to say evil or wrong, but he did it on his own, regardless of their choice. Well, they told him the rule, but he didn't agree with it. He has his own opinions. They don't know evil. So Laban's obviously Jacob's response after he was flock horoscope, he kisses Rachel and then tells her who he is, and he weeps and yada yada. We'll get the story of how they all greet and meet one another. All right, so in this case, you know what? I couldn't answer the question fairly. But we associate kiss as a form of physical affection to of someone, either you're like a son or a daughter, a mother, a father, or a wife and a husband. Well, in some cultures, kissing on the side of the face, cheeks, is pretty common for non-physical relatives, that as a form of greeting. It doesn't, none of them will specify where he kisses him. And I believe it is when he returns back and sees his brother again, Esau, though some dispute this fact, the Bible records Esau kisses Jacob back again, probably most likely on the side as a form of greeting. Some argue he bites him, but it's just that I won't discuss the details of that. It's an argument that's a long, very old argument. So greeting, if this form is not necessarily a strange thing in their particular culture, which may be more so in ours. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Today I do not know what they do today. Today Islam's taken over and has done a lot of things, so I'm not sure what they do today. Islam's pretty strict about even getting too close to a girl, you kill her first. And some strange stuff they're doing in their philosophies. Anyway, let's move on. And, okay. Let's jump to this, so we're not going to go through all the stories, but Leah and Rachel. She agrees for 7 years' work. I don't have time to do this. Shouldn't take too long. So I'm going to go through. I want to get to the point of the sheep real quick. Well, I won't get there just yet. So 7 years. We discussed this many times before as you go through this section. Did Leah know that Rachel was the agreement? Yes. Leah would have known that Rachel was the agreed wife upon which the 7 years would be. How would she know? It's been 7 years. Have you ever known sisters not to talk? They always talk. Until they're mad, and that lasts for a while, but eventually they don't get mad at each other. They talk a lot. So Rachel probably knew, Rachel, you can pretty shame, and Leah most likely talked. And most likely Laban probably told his wife. And she probably told her daughters too. So communication, even though maybe poor, that's not usually a poor one. That's pretty commonly done. So Leah knew. What did she do about it? Ah, that's a good question. Could she have done something about it? Let's discuss that for just a moment. When Eleazar went to Laban when Laban was young, and to get Rebekah, they had asked, or he had pointed out that he was asking to get Rebekah for the hand of marriage to Isaac. Now, in that time, with that interaction between them, Laban and his mom asked Rebekah, "Will you go with this man?" So she has input on what she's willing or not willing to do. And we assume, because she said yes, she wanted to go, but if she had said no, it's an assumption they would not have forced her to go. That implies that a woman, a daughter, still has input on whether she will or not marry someone. She has some say, maybe not overarching like master authority, but there is some input she's allowed to give with the example that Laban gave to his own sister. Now, because he was Rebecca's sister, it's the thought is most likely if he treated his own sister that way, he probably would teach his daughter similarly. Probably. We don't know for certain, but probably. Because that's the way he was raised. So to raise it, at least someone has an input. Maybe not can't overrule necessarily, but at least some input. So we don't know how much input she had or what she was willing to say yes or no to, but could she have told Jacob? Yes. Did she? No. So whether or not she had authority to say no, she still had authority to at least let him know. But she chose not to. Now, Laban may have intended that he marry Leah off sometime in those 7 year spans, thinking, well, somebody probably would want to marry her between now and then. And this didn't happen. We don't know the intent behind anybody. But we just know what actually did or didn't occur. So, of course, 7 years go by. Jacob goes and sleeps with the wrong girl. Why? He's probably drunk. He just went through a very big party, went through, and alcohol tends to skew people's, as you haven't noticed, our thoughts and abilities. So, Leah knew, obviously, she didn't tell anybody about it, didn't tell Jacob about it. I assume she didn't tell her sister, Rachel, about it, because otherwise she probably would have told Jacob. But anyway, Leah knew what was going on. Jacob could have been told. He obviously wasn't. He didn't know what was happening. The whole week goes, and we discussed that briefly a few moments ago, regarding the fact that he had two wives. Leah was the first. Rachel's the second. And what does the Torah say about that? It does say one thing about it. Never marry two sisters. The Torah instructs them. You do not marry sisters. Regardless of whether or not you have one and she passed away and married the second sister, you don't marry sisters. Why do you think that would be? Bingo. What happened here? They fought. They bickered. They're competing each other. You don't do that. And of course, obviously, Leah accuses Rachel of stealing her husband and when he interacts with Reuben. So, yes, they knew, Leah knew, Rachel maybe not, did not know. We don't know how much she knew ahead of time or not. But, either way, this is how it happened. The two handmaids, Zilpah and Bilhah, these are typically, when a man, in this case Laban, has multiple wives. It's pretty common to have multiple wives. Even Jacob has four in this instance. Most likely he did. And we'll discuss that in a second here. The first wife gets a certain amount of rights for her children. That's a Gibeah. It's the first wife, primary wife. And it appears that Rachel and Leah are probably of his first wife. So he would have Rachel and Leah. I say that because the actions that he does here was common for their time in the Middle East. Another wife or a concubine, he would be the father of Bilhah and Zilpah. But not from his first wife. So Bilhah and Zilpah are still his daughters, but he has more authority over them because it is really from a second or a concubine as opposed to his primary wife. It was commonly done where your second children from a second wife were given as servants to your first children. That was pretty commonly done. Nothing, we wouldn't do it today, but that was done at that time. And since Rachel and Leah complained to Jacob about the father burning through all their inheritance, any sons Laban had probably did not come from the first wife. It may have come from any one of his other wives. So the inheritance rights are different. Mind you, Laban is not a Torah observant man. So inheritance rights and how it was done is different than what our Torah describes for men to do, for their firstborn sons and second, all those details. It is, at that time, it's done by wife, firstborn wife. We know this by the example from Abraham and Hagar and Abraham and Keturah. Abraham had a wife, Sarah. Any offspring Sarah has is the primary offspring that all of his possessions are supposed to go to, male or female. That's who it's supposed to be at that time. Right? Even though a second wife, Hagar, had a baby as well, who was older, an older son, he is still considered supposed to be a servant to anyone from Sarah's line. Of course, Sarah being barren didn't make a difference. But if Sarah wasn't barren, that's how it would work out. And any of Keturah, which Abraham marries after Sarah dies, all of her children will be then considered servants to Isaac, because he is the primary. That's how inheritance worked then. Not the way how the Torah describes it later on, but that's how it worked at that time. Make sense? So all inheritance originally would have gone to Rachel and Leah, and they complained that their father burned through it all. He spent it. It's all gone. The other children would have been the servants to those two girls in their livelihood and what they would do. Yes, Zelophehad is five daughters, yes. $5 is Zelophehad. Later in Exodus, when the Torah is given as instruction, in Exodus we have a different instruction. We'll talk about that, might as well, right now. So when the Torah comes along in Exodus, Moses explains, when you have, now mind you, the Torah was originally written for a man and his wife. Not a man and his 10 wives. It was a man and his wife. That was the idea behind the concept. So, you have one man and one wife. They have children. However many children it happens to be. In that instance, you don't have multiple other wives that have kids. That wasn't the intent in the description. So, in this instance, with the nuclear family as we discuss it, as a husband, wife, and children, it's supposed to, the Torah explains, all right, your property, two parts go to your firstborn son. All those parts are distributed amongst your other sons, with daughters not receiving any of it. That was the intent. The reason daughters didn't receive it is because they're supposed to marry their husbands, who would have had their own husband's inheritance. So they otherwise you would accumulate, the daughters would be very, very wealthy, and the sons become very, very poor if you had the daughters receive everything. So that's how it was brought up. But Zelophehad has five daughters and no sons. He says, what do I do? And obviously, God says, here's the instruction. In this instance, the daughters give them all equal portion. There is no firstborn, secondborn, all equal portion. But when they must marry with inside their tribes, doesn't deviate and go off and do something else, and all the inheritance runs away with them. So the daughters had a responsibility for the possession of the property they received. This means something to me. I have to do something with it. I can't just spend it and squander it and do what I want. There's a specific task now that I must do with this property. So it puts the responsibility upon the daughters that normally would go to the sons. That's how it was done in that instance. But again, it was for a man and a woman, one nuclear family, not what it is the Middle East at that time, which was many, many wives, and who cared how many you had. Let's see, because something that's more important, I want to get to this. How they go with all the kids? They had a bunch of kids. You know their names, right? There's Reuben, there's Simeon, there's Levi. All the girls had a lot of sons. I would bring something else to you, which is more important to my discussion today. What was that?
I think it was 12 people.
13 died of the girl. Dinah, 13. Yeah, you're right, 12 sons, you're right. He had a lot, he had offspring. That is the 13th one. In this span of time, now mind you, he's having all these kids in about 7 years, give or take. I won't say exact, because the Bible is not necessarily chronological. It's topic-based. So you have about 7 years to have 13 children. It's a lot of kids. There's between four wives, which helps distribute the workload out of it. that's better. But still a lot of kids. And mind you, Leah has, what, 9 of them herself?
Six.
So she has 6 sons and 7 sons and a daughter. The Dinah, the daughter. She has a whole bunch of herself. She gets 4, 5, 7. Oh, right. She has 7 herself. So Leah gets 7 kids alone. Her handmaid, Zilpah, has 2. Rachel, or Rachel, not yet. She has 1 at this point, the first 7 years. She gets a Benjamin later on as they're traveling through the countryside. And Bilhah has 2. Say 7, 9, 11, 12. There's only 12 yet, because the 13th one doesn't show up later. So we'll get 12 for the first 7 years. In this example, if I was in Leah's shoes, that's a lot of kids for 7 years. Hence, Torah tradition states that she probably had twins somewhere in that grouping. Because having 7 kids in 7 years, not impossible, but really hard. And not to mention, in that 7-year span, Zilpah had 2 kids during that time period while Leah couldn't have children. So there was a span which Zilpah had 2 children back to back, you know, at least 18 months apart. So 18 months of that 7 years, Leah wasn't giving birth and Zilpah had them. So the point is, So the point is that what likely was occurring in this storyline, at the 7 years end, when Rachel has her son, Leah may not be finished having children yet. When they group it together in categories of how many are Leah's kids, this is not necessarily chronological in the form of a time crunch, but rather, here's a list of the children she has. They could have been mixed in with all the balance of the full 13 years he was still going to be there while he was married to her. So any one of them could be born in that time slot. That's the idea that Rachel's birth to Yosef, that was the time slot. The 7 years was now done. But of course, he'd work for 6 more years. That doesn't seem that all of Leah's kids were born yet. She could have still been having children or having children after Yosef. We don't know. But that's the idea behind it. Yosef is the oldest one of Rachel, but not necessarily the oldest one of Leah. Dinah could have been younger. We do not know. Or she may have had twins. Hard to say. But that would be a lot of kids to have in a short period of time. Now there's more interesting stuff. The 6 years. So we'll discuss this. We discussed it already. This is where the explanation of where how Jacob interacted and the relationship, how it's all working, starts to make sense. It's in the sheep. The sheep that he does. What's the deal he makes with Laban? What's the deal he makes with Laban? What's the deal for the remaining 6 years? Speckled? I'm going to abbreviate. Speckled, spot, colored, striped. Yeah, the 6 years that Jacob serves Laban. After he has his wives, he has a total of 14 years that have been spent. He has a whole bunch of kids now, but he hasn't built his own house yet. He's building Laban's house. So what was the deal he made with Laban? That he would receive the speckled, the spotted, the colored, the striped, the non-economically feasible sheep. Now, what is valuable of the other sheep? The white ones. What are they used for? Wool. Wool. You can change white into almost any other color. Can you change brown into any other color? Not really. Not that well. Mind you, they don't have bleach. We don't have the bleaching process of getting color out. It is just, this is the color it is. You can make it darker, but that's about it. What is the value of white? It's very valuable. It's clean. It can turn into any color you wish. It gets the most about a dollar amount for your sheep. That's why you walk around the countryside, you see a lot of gray or white sheep around because the clothing, it's gray because it's dirty. If you wash it, it's a little whiter. you can then sell the wool and be useful to it. What kind of sheep does Jacob want? Yeah, the ones that are unwanted. The stripe, the unwanted ones. The ones who are useless to the person who actually cared. Ah, all the unwanted. That's the symbol. So Laban's, this deal, Laban thinks it's great. So Jacob takes these. So Jacob takes all the unwanted ones. So all these, why don't go into Jacob? Now what's Jacob's task? What does he do? The first thing he does, he walks the field, gathers all the unwanted ones. He then puts a 3 days journey between all the unwanted ones and all the white ones. Separates them all out. Now, can they mate? No. They're 3 days journey apart from each other. They're not mating. So the speckled and spotted are not making more speckled and spotted amongst the whites. And the whites aren't making more whites amongst the speckled and spotted. They're completely divided out. They're separated out in every way. They cannot interact or hurt. He repeats himself a number of times in the Torah. They even pasture them separately. They always make sure they're separate all the time. So the unwanted ones, Jacob separates out. And Laban, of course, gets the wanted ones, all the white ones. Mind you, what does name mean? White. Laban's name means white. White lie. Good point. Laban lie is a white lie. So white sheep go to Laban. Laban's name means white. He gets the white sheep. Jacob gets all the other colored ones. So when we look at Jacob's deal and his instructions, what he get reminds us that think of who Jacob is, what character Jacob's playing in the story. Not just the story, but the story before it too with Esau. A deceiver, but what's he doing? He prospers his sheep, prospers himself. What does Messiah do? Now, mind you, when Messiah was alive on this earth, a flesh and blood human being, who was in charge of the earth? Now, Satan was. Satan still is. He owns the earth. It's his. And God says, you roam and you do this destructive stuff. This is your stuff you're doing. God will clean it up. But Satan offers him, you want a city? I give you a city. Bow down and worship me. Well, he can't offer a city unless he owns it. Right? You can't offer that you don't own. Well, Satan owns it. So I can give it to you. Well, he runs it. God made it. That's about God's creation, which we'll discuss that in a minute. Satan deceived the earth. Satan has been in charge or been operating here for a very long time. That Satan took over the leadership? Right. That's what we're referring to. When we have, for example, our government and the federal government and state government, for that matter, too, they own the land we're standing on. They own it. Now, physically, well, we're here. We built it. We did this. We paid for it. No, you don't. You don't eat anything. They own it. Now, are they taking care of it? Of course not. You are. You're working it. You're doing all the work. But they're the ones who own it. We pay taxes to prove that they own it. So no matter what happens, they are the ultimate owners. Now, they aren't the operators. They don't do any of the work for it, but they still own it. Satan the same way. So he owns it. Now, we're working here. Said, no, you don't belong here. Go away. But he still owns it. It's still his because through his power and that God gave him temporary power to destroy, not that he owns the dirt. When I'm referring to Satan owning something, I'm referring to people. Because God can create dirt and rocks and trees. That's not Satan's value. What does Satan want? People. So when Satan owns something, he owns people. The earth is made of people. Yes, there's rocks, there's trees, there's water. that doesn't matter. It's the people that matter. And we can look around us, does Satan own the people? He owns tons of them. So that he still has power over them. So the city says, here's the city. Here's any city you want. Because he owns the people that are in it. Now, are there individuals that say, forget you, I'm not going to obey you? Of course. But the overall power and control is still his. Now, is he going to keep it? Of course not. But that's what he's trying to do. So right now, Satan owns, I use the term loosely, owns the earth, owns the people in that format. So when Messiah comes along, Messiah obviously did his work, he died, all this very stuff. What did he do to Satan's people ownership? He took a chunk out. And took another chunk out. Takes the chunks out. He used his own process of dying to pay for their sins to remove the ownership, the birthright that Satan has. So in a manner of speaking, Jacob plays the messianic role, while Esau plays the satanic or Satan role, the adversary role. Laban plays the adversary role too. And Jacob plays the messianic role of gathering those that are not wanted. It's a symbolism. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, and there was also the symbolism of come to this place that's more fertile. You know, like putting out the sticks to stimulate the birth among the unwanted.
Yes.
You know, because
we're blessed.
Because, you know, you bring up a good point about the ruler of this world, the adversary. Because if Satan was to just say, okay, you can have this city and that city, if your dominion over somebody is, you know, your line and they bought into the rebellion, how do you give someone back? How do you give those people back? What do you just like kind of hit them with a little magic wand and suddenly their rebellion goes away? No, people have rebelled and they've gone in a different direction. Well, how do you give the people back? You basically kind of like with the symbol of, you know, the striped sticks, you lure them to a place that's more fertile.
That's better. Yes, that's exactly. Better. Make them want
and
that.
And so that is what Messiah did.
Mm-hmm.
He lured them to a place that's more fertile.
Yeah. It's a beautiful symbol. It's a great parallel that God's doing here in playing without this in this role. So it helps, at least me, to understand a little better on Jacob's mentality and his process, what God's using him for. He's using him as a messianic role. Because Messiah was not a desirable person, was he? Not at all. But yet he saved tons and tons of people out of the hands of those who were supposedly more valuable, more powerful, all this great stuff they supposedly had. He took the unwanted ones. This is where the symbol gets a little more complicated, but also funner. In the dream that Jacob has regarding the sheep. I'll erase this.
What dream?
The dream. So Jacob talks to his wives and tells about, hey, I've had this image of these sheep mounting all the rams, mounting these sheep amongst them in Laban's flock. So when he's about to flee, now mind you, I mentioned before, all the striped and all the speckled and colored sheep are separate than the white ones. So all of Jacob's work is strictly with white-looking sheep. All of the sheep look white. The rams are white, the sheep are white. Everything is white, all right? So in this imagery, we have a bunch of white sheep. And goats too. I shouldn't say just sheep. There's actually goats too. When he sees these sheep and goats, and they're all white. Now, when he's putting up these little sticks, there is no speckled sheep, speckled goat mounting the white sheep. There aren't any speckled colored goats. They're all white goats. He's putting these sticks up there. Every male goat, every female goat, is all white, right? Because they're all Laban's flocks. But in the vision the angel gives him after 6 years, what does he describe in his vision? What did the male goats look like in his vision, the dream? They were speckled. Now in the dream, all the males were speckled. whatever, close to speckled. Now, were they actually speckled? Of course not. They're all white. Can you see someone's genes, the DNA? Of course not. All you can see is on the outside. But God sees the DNA is. And so God's showing Jacob what the inner DNA of these sheep actually is. Yes, they are white the outside, but what's inside them isn't white. So this dream explained what Jacob was seeing. It had nothing to do with the sticks being peeled or not. The sticks being peeled is just a technique of making sheep produce and have lambs. That's nothing new about that. But the spotted and speckled vision that he got was that the male ones, their sperm, their DNA, that happened to be producing speckled, spotted, white, and colored, or not white, but colored sheep. That's what he was doing. When Jacob took the sticks down for the late producing lambs, for the late spring, you don't usually want a late lamb because it usually dies in the wintertime. It's not a very pleasant time to have a sheep or a lamb. He took the sticks down to prevent or reduce the number popularly at that time. Well, God wasn't having the speckled and spotted DNA sheep or goats doing that. It was now the truly white ones were then they're doing their normal work. Now, mind you, Laban's flock was small when Jacob came. So what's God returning it to? Small when Jacob leaves. So this is probably the method by which Laban was normally running his business, having his sheep just do their thing and just figure out what survives. He's not necessarily the smartest guy in this process. So in the dream, he sees that. Now, meanwhile, in Jacob's sheep, who's in charge of Jacob's sheep? No, he's not. Who's in charge of all of Jacob's sheep? His sons. All of Jacob's sheep, his sons are in charge of. Now, how old are his sons? Well, Reuben's about 7. Reuben's about 7 or 8 years old. So that ballpark when this happens. He's pretty young. Now, mind you, he has brothers too. They're all working together. He may have had servants working for him. I do not know. But Jacob's sons were in charge. And his sons took all the speckled and spotted and all these various other colored sheep. Every time one shows up from this group, it comes over here. Meanwhile, his sons are not dumb. His sons are probably using the same method Jacob's using when their sheep are in heat. God told him what to do because they're his sons. So his sons probably also stripped the sticks and did everything that their father showed them to do so they'd have a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger flock. Now, is Jacob interested in selling the sheep's wool? Probably not, because he's not going to make much money from that. What's he interested in? Growing his flock. Growing his flock. That's what he's more value in Jacob. Jacob sees the value as the animal, not the sheep or the wool that's so valuable. Just want to get to this discussion. When Messiah shows up, who is in charge of all the white sheep? Who are white sheep, by the way? Righteous people, righteous followers of God. Who is in charge of all the white sheep? Not yet. When he first shows up, he's a man of flesh and blood, human being. He's not in charge of anybody yet. House of Israel. I'm jumping 2,000 years. In the house of Israel is in charge. The rabbinical leadership, the priests, the Pharisees, they're in charge of the white sheep. They're supposed to be the examples of white sheep. The scribes, Pharisees, they're still in charge of all. So they're supposed to be in charge and instructing and teaching what type of sheep are they producing? Speckled and spotted, the ones that nobody wants. The whitewashed tombs. Exact example. They're white on the outside. The inside, they're full of disgusting gross. Death. That's the imagery. That's the reason for it. So we have this example that the white sheep on the outside look white. They look perfectly clean. On the inside, they're full of dirtiness, color, disgusting, grotesque things you wouldn't want. That's the idea of the coloring, of course. And Messiah is saying, I'll take all of those. I'll take all those. Because you guys are only clean on the outside. Inside, you're not. So Messiah and Jacob are playing a similar role. Jacob is gathering all the unwanted sheep to him. He'll take them, nurture them, put them in charge of his sons and servants to continue helping their growth. The ones who are appear white on the outside, appear desirable, appear to be perfect, says, I don't want those. They're empty. They're not strong. Jacob points that Laban's flock becomes weak. The ones who are white on the outside are not strong on the inside. I don't want those. Get rid of them. You can keep them. Go away. But they are producing more of the speckled ones. Because when somebody comes from them and says, oh, I don't agree with you, you're now speckled. Go away. You're now unclean. Go away. The process of rejection happens. It wasn't by a single man in charge, by a people, a group of people, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, all the various groups. Their job was to create white-looking sheep. And none of them were really white. Does it make sense? So now we have this example of what Jacob was doing in the form of his messianic role and how he was handling Laban. So understand a little bit more as far as Jacob's intent and why the speckled and spotted and colored sheep are desirable to him. Because that's what's desirable to God. He wants those. He can make them white. Where God's, I'm making them white. I'm making them desirable, making them wanted. Make sense? Now we understand why the reasoning of this sheep dividing up was. So Jacob is playing in this sheep division role a messianic role. In which case, if he's playing a messianic role in the sheep dividing up, he is also playing the messianic role in his interaction with Laban and his interaction with Esau. So when the scribes and Pharisees, were they thrilled when Messiah showed up and took all the colored sheep away?
Oh, of course!
They want him dead. Now, what was Laban's reaction?
He was
angry. What's he going to do? What did he want to do? Now, Laban points out, I showed up and God showed, this Laban speaking, in a dream not to do harm or good to you. So, what was Laban's intent if God had not shown up? Probably going to hurt him or take him. Take whatever you had away and say, go away or I'll kill you for it. What was the scribes and Pharisees' reaction to Messiah? The same. I'm going to go ahead and get rid of you because you're causing a nuisance. You're a problem. These are our people because they were complaining that all people were following this guy. That all the peons and the weak people and those who were this and that and the other thing have these problems. They're following this guy out in the wilderness. And they're not following us like they're supposed to. They're not revering and following us. Well, just like Laban's reactions is very similar. So he said, Laban and Jacob are playing a messianic role and a adversary role together, against each other. Which, again, makes sense with the image we have amongst the sheep. It's consistent. So we apply that same role back to Jacob and Esau. It's the same imagery. Who is the current owner, he's from loosely, of the people of the earth? Hasatan. He still owns them, still runs them. But who has stolen them away from him?
Messiah
did. So what did Jacob do? Steal them away. So Jacob's deceiving characteristic isn't a bad thing. That's a tool that is used. Did Messiah deceive Hasatan?
No, he asked him off.
Did he trick him? Yes, because Hasadon lost. They were playing a game of temptation, and Hasadon lost his game, and Messiah won. And Messiah died, but death couldn't hold him. So he comes back because he wasn't worthy of death. So in the game he was playing, Messiah outsmarted Hasadon. So the game that Jacob and Esau are playing, Jacob outsmarts Esau. It's not a bad thing. We look at it as a bad thing. Oh, what a terrible guy he was. Wait a minute. This was good. It was already set. I mean, just like Messiah was already set to do this anyway. Messiah was set that he's going to be doing this. Though Satan didn't like that. Hasan didn't want that. But Messiah was already preordained, preset, pre-prophesied this would happen. It was already set, just like Jacob and Esau, that it was already preset with Rebecca when they were still babies. So it was already pre-done. But how it was carried out was it deceived Esau and Jacob wins. And in this instance, he deceived Laban and Jacob wins. The same imagery. Does it make sense? Any questions? It's a beautiful set which God had set up this way. It wasn't by accident. And the reason I bring these connections up is because anytime you have three days in particular, listed twice here, and someone that should be dead doesn't be dead, or somebody should be alive ends up being dead, it's a messianic imagery. In this instance, we have 3 days, twice. There are 3 days separation between the sheep, the 3 days separation. He puts a speckled sheep on one side, 3 days journey from the white sheep, because you become Messiah's after his 3 days and resurrection, then all the speckled become his. That's how imagery was done. So this is the same imagery. 3 days journey between the white ones and then now the speckled ones, and Messiah, he takes them all the 3 days. Then the second set of 3 days is Laban doesn't find out that he left, meaning Laban has no idea he lost anything until the third day. So again, another messianic example. So we have the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and all the various the scribes are there having no idea they just lost until 3 days later he rises from the dead. Then they realize, uh-oh, we just lost. We just lost everything. But they realize something has gone wrong. Yeah, but something went wrong. So their realization came to them after the third day when he rose up from the dead. And now they have this realization, all of our black and spotted and colored sheep aren't coming back. That realization, they're not going to come back, but this is going to continue on and continue to grow. Hence we have the book of Acts and various of the activities that happen. And so both examples of 3 days on the third day is when Laban finds out. So both examples are listed here. We both have the example of some that once was one person's for their life, whatever, turned into somebody else. They lose everything. Laban loses everything in both instances. Laban loses everything on the third day when he realizes that Jacob's gone. He loses his children. He loses his daughters, grandchildren technically, as well as all this flock. He loses everything on the third day. It came to realization. And of course, the separation between them both is 3 days. Does that make sense? Okay, so again, these are all messianic roles. Imagery to remind us and know what Messiah shows up, what he's going to look like. Yes?
The sisters, I mean, they said something about, they were saying that our father took our inheritance. Remember the girls were saying that? What does that mean?
I mentioned that briefly earlier. Did I erase it already? I erased it already. About, at that time, it's the first wife. Yeah, the first wife, her children receive inheritance, the inheritance. It didn't matter, male or female. The first wife's children receive it, the bulk of it. And the others will receive gifts like Abraham had done. So if he had spent their inheritance, means he gave or used their inheritance and gave it to his other children, his other sons, whoever, that were not necessarily from his first wife, Laban. That was their complaint, that he had spent it all, that all their inheritance. It would have been Laban's first wife, most likely, because that was the culture at the time. Yes, that shows up later. That shows up later. Yeah, later in the Torah with Zelophehad and his daughters, that issue with not having sons. Right, in this story, Laban does not follow. Right, that's what they wind up using. This story here, Laban doesn't have that law. He doesn't obey that law. It doesn't exist. It's a different culture, different belief, different gods. Same family, but they didn't have gods. How do we know he didn't had different gods?
Well, my family has nothing to do with gods.
Well, yeah, exactly. Our families are variations of who doesn't believe God and who does, right? There's a whole bunch of mix. I think there is one, think there isn't one, whatever. Now we know Laban believes in different gods. How do we know that? What did Rachel steal? Rachel stole Laban's gods, his idols. So Laban was at least some form of an idol worshiper. Now, no, it doesn't appear to. They do. They bury them. They get buried. So he doesn't get these back. These get buried. When Jacob makes it back to Bethel, the actual same spot where he started out with, he tells everybody in his household, all the servants, take every idol you have, every image you ever got, gather to me. He takes it and he buries them under a tree. They're gone. And then he brings it to Bethel, so it's official, the idol worship is dead to them all. It's buried. They have a rough description of where it was at. I'm sure somebody probably looted it by now. But whatever it was, he got rid of it all. So Laban never got them back. Now, I'm sure by that time, Jacob probably found out, hey, where'd these come from? Take a wild guess. He probably realized then what happened and how they, where they came from and that his wife had had them. But that we won't discuss that time, that point yet. It doesn't discuss that. So Laban has given the gods, else Rachel would have nothing to steal. Right? And she stole something. And that's, of course, he refers to them as his gods. So whatever idol he believed in, that's what he believed in. Remember, though, when he was a younger man, when Eleazar came to get Rebekah as wife for Isaac, he, Laban, and his father, I forgot his father's name. No. Laban's dad. Bethuel. His mother Bethuel, as well as his Laban's mom, they all recognized and knew what God Abraham and what Eliezer was talking about. They knew which one it was. So it's not that he was too far removed from that. He still had a connection, but apparently wasn't a very good one. Mind you, remember when Abraham and Lot were together, and Lot went his way and hung out in Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham went up to Hebron, or down to Hebron? What good influence did Lot have upon the people of Sodom? Zero. So he had no good influence on them. So if you have a good God-believing person amongst the society surrounded about idol worshippers, what happens to God-believing person? They degrade. And then what happens to their children and their grandchildren, great-grandchildren? They intermarry and it all becomes a hodgepodge mix of whatever. So that's what's going to happen. And Nahor and Laban's grandfather, as well as Terah, the great-grandfather, they would have believed and understood some connection of what their true God is, who true God was. They would have taught their children, but it's not going to last for long. Eventually, it degrades amongst the world around them. Any questions or comments? Hope it's a good discussion as far as understanding Jacob better.
I don't know with Rachel, did she ever really believe the way Jacob did, you think, or it was kind of odd?
I do not know. I can't think of where it is, where it says Rachel weeps for her children. I can't think of which prophet it says that. It's recorded again in the New Testament when they killed Herod. So Herod... When Herod goes off and executes a bunch of children in Messiah's time, it recalls the prophecy of Rachel weeping for her children. So even though she, by herself, may or may not have understood God well, I don't know. But in the core of the prophets, she still knew what was right and what was wrong. And so she knew what Herod was doing was wrong. And she still wept for her children. So she still had a good knowledge of what was right and wrong. And Joseph was her son. Now Herod, note, killed mostly Jews. Meaning from the tribe of Judah. Because that's who's left. Everybody else is gone. So that's who Herod's killing. But the prophecy is that Rachel weeps for her children. But whose children are being killed? Judah. It's not a biological weeping. It's not a biological child. It's a spiritual one. So when Herod does this act, it's the spiritual children of Rachel that's weeping. It's not that she has to be from Benjamin or from Joseph. It's something about biological. It is those who are following what is good is what she weeps over. So she has a knowledge, or had a knowledge, of what was good and what was right. Yes?
I would like to bring out, I think that Rachel stole those images, not for religious significance, but she felt it was a fair wage for all the work that had been done, and that's why she stole them.
That could be. We do not know. That could be. It cost her whole life. Yes, Deborah. I'm going to call it quits real quick.
A biblical book, but they said that they stole them because, which leads back to the tablets, that those gods were able to see into the future, just like if we were to look in the dark tablets, that they were, the reason she took them, it says in some of these writings, was because they had an ability to look into the future. or what to knowledge that they could see where they were going. And, you know, what is this stuff, technology?
That's a story I had never heard, so I do not know. I can't speak of it. I'm inclined not to generally believe it, simply because it would have to have a demon inside the little tool or god to do that. Right, and God points out many places, these are rocks. They have eyes they can't see, and mouths they can't eat or speak, and nose they can't breathe. I realize our little cell phones are similar in that way. So, so I'm not inclined to think that that's a very good analogy, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. I'm just saying I'm not inclined to believe it. And I don't know. I hadn't read that, so I can't speak to it. Any comments or questions? Beliefs, opinions? Oh, yes, go ahead. Don't stop. Don't stop on what? My time's up. It ended 2 minutes ago. No, I would call it quits for the day. Close the prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for this time with you, to learn what is fair and just and right, and to understand more about your ways. For you are a wise and kind Creator. Father, bless us as we teach our children, grandchildren, to be good followers of your ways, to listen to you, to trust you, to read what you have written for us, that we learn and follow well. Help us to serve you and serve one another. We ask your blessing upon the rest of our Shabbat, upon the food that we eat. You'll grant us peace. We pray for in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.